Jim was telling me normally he gets an introduction that's very monotone, so I'm sitting there trying to think of something very creative to say, and I've completely lost it.
There you go.
So I'm just going to cut to the chase with this and introduce Jim Armstrong from Telos Omnia Axia.
Hi, thanks, Greg Dahl, for introducing me. For those of you who don't know, if we haven't met before and you don't know me, I've been in the broadcast industry as far as equipment sales go for the last 12 years with stops at Sierra Automated Systems, Telos Omnia Axia for the last couple, and got my start when I got out of radio in Boston over to Burke Technology. So kind of been around this now for about a dozen years. Prior to that, I was an on-air guy in Boston just a general air talent as well as a ops manager for a kilowatt station in Salem, Mass. So we want to talk a little bit about how much we're really saving. Companies offering new technologies, they often claim that increased efficiencies in this IP domain that we talk about. Usual claims come in terms of capital cost savings, installation labor savings, and future savings on maintenance of this gear. Who's actually measured these claims? What data justifies all the ad pitches we see and anecdotal stories brought before us? And can we quantify a new approach maybe just for more fun than the old approach? Well, Telos Omnia Axia are working to measure, collect, and report on this work process data. As broadcast engineers, well, we're curious as to whether the marketing department's claims are really valid. You know, they talk about all this stuff, and we're saving here, we're saving there. Does it really mean anything? Well, we went through and we talked to some of our guys that are using IP audio in broadcast markets, and we felt this was a great way to kind of measure what they're all about. So, is it hyperbole? Is it a real savings, you know, documented by real users? Audio proponents, the folks here at Axia, and now we're starting to see other companies get into the IP routing domain. Of course, we're familiar with IP audio for other things now, transmission lines. Basically, all areas of broadcasting are now jumping into the IP domain. The folks at Axia now, we've been doing it for about 6 years as far as distributing audio using IP. And we've come up with several things that this, you know, the marketing department's come up with several things that say we do better than the old way of doing things where we had twisted pair. We made a lot of claims. We've talked about, is it actually saving cash or is it hyperbole or, you know, cow pies? And we like to think that there's more to it than just sales talk or hyperbole. And how do we find this out? Well, we've looked at how a traditional system is actually designed. It's a lot different than a console-centric system. In the console-centric system, we would have all of our sources wired in directly to a console. And then we'd be in that room when we wanted to use that particular source. But to get to a different source or something else, you had to get up, go in the other room. Kind of cumbersome. Not to mention that the cabling between that console and a rack room is pretty substantial. And now we're getting to the point where copper is even more expensive than it's ever been. So things are getting more costly as far as the old way of doing things. With a router-centric sort of application, meaning we put in an IT switch in your center, in your rack room, or in your studio, if you want, and connect it all with a simple piece of Cat 5, we're saving now large bundles of money. And I'm sure the guys at Gepco and Belden don't want to hear this, but, you know, they sell Cat 5, Cat 6, too. That the multi-pair that we used to have is gone away. So now let's do it and wire up a system, putting our entry points or converters, if you will. We call them nodes. Other folks have different names for them. But we put those where we need them. And then you have the ability to tie back to a central point just using simple off-the-shelf Cat 5. It makes it so much easier. Now, wiring studios is really fast and easy. In this IP-based studio here, there isn't a cable that's longer than a meter long. You can see the end of each cable. And that really helps out when you're going to do the install. It makes it quick and simple. I'm not tracing down my eye on this big bundle of cable looking for that one that's giving me an issue, or if there's a ground short, or if there's hum somewhere. Well, in this case, I can see the end of both cables. And that makes installation, well, gone from days and weeks into hours now, where we actually plug stuff in and away we go. In this installation here, well, the IP, they didn't even have a local broadcast on-staff engineer do the install. They did the thing where they got a telephone vendor to come in, and they wired up the facility with all Cat 5. And KVM, a couple things here and there, and boom, the whole studio is in and done in hours. Now, here's a facility, here's a contrast for you. This facility that's just 3 years old was built using fully digital consoles and a digital routing system based on TDM technology, not IP audio. Now, the manufacturer claimed in their advertising you'd get a lot of wire and presumably time to wire their system. It requires a lot to do that. You know, when you're punching down all of these blocks and all of these cables, it takes a serious amount of time. What do you think? How long does this stuff usually take to put in to do a studio like this? Yeah, 3 months. I've seen guys that have been on site where they hire somebody from a manufacturer to come in, and they live there for the next 90 days. And they're sitting there in the back room, up to their elbows in, you know, a pair of wire cutters, some shrink tubing, soldering iron if they got it, and a couple of punch tools with a fresh blade on it, so they can go down and trace everything out. Well, this installation here actually took 9 engineers over a 3-month period to do. 8 of the engineers required hotel rooms, meals, travel time away from home, and most of them still had responsibilities for radio stations from which they were pulled away from to do this project. So it takes a lot of time and effort to get all this in. Now, contract to the former IP installation such as this, trying to compare apples to apples, it's difficult, since topologies are totally different between all manufacturers. The cabling and Cisco Ethernet switches shown here are providing similar cross-connecting capabilities as our previous example. And Cat 6 cabling was pulled in a matter of hours from studios. Cat cable terminations, quick, reliable. They plug in, and that's about all there is to it. Patch cords plug in quickly, and it's easy to dress them neatly, which is very important. Especially when, you know, we're dealing with Cat 5, you know, the old days of using tie wraps, cable tie wraps, are gone. You want to use something more like Velcro, so we're not damaging the cable. So, anyway, it's really important to dress these things neatly. Configuring Ethernet switches can be done in under 10 minutes each, so they're simple to do. Especially after you do the first one, they all get easier after that. Moreover, subsequent changes in equipment or studio use is convenient and usually done with a web browser. Now, I talked about this just to kind of give you an idea of where we've been, our thoughts behind it, the claims that have been made. And now we're going to bring in some guys that actually have gone through this process and have done some changes. So I want to bring in some folks and talk about them a little bit. Hello. There we go. Obviously, we got everybody's favorite Tom Ray from WOR. Rodney Bellazaire from WQXR in New York City. This is actually kind of a Manhattan-centric slide here, or the next few anyway. Chris Tobin from WINS, 1010 Winds. And Matt Galick from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. All of these gentlemen have done facility builds using the IP architecture. And we wanted real answers. We're going through this. We wanted guys that have done it, that have skinned their knees on it, and they can tell you what they've found. Now, I want to go through some of their builds with you and talk a little bit about them. Tom Ray has four streams, 24/7, program one to air. Chris Tobin at Wins, he did a retrofit. So he took some old studios and they kind of hopscotched them as they went along, where they'd clear one out, move everybody over to the second one, and then play musical chairs. Where are you? There we go. Ronnie Belazaire did a retrofit. Now, he's using older consoles and just basically put in a new routing system by putting in some nodes, as we call them. I'm trying to keep this as generic as possible and not get brand specific. It's kind of hard to do. So bear with me on that if I slip. And the folks at the Metropolitan Opera House did a new studio, and they have a complete facility there. Just one studio to broadcast to Sirius satellite content. And they've got a couple of nodes down on the stage where they interview people and bring it back up. So those are the guys we're going to talk, or we've talked to and got some quotes from for you to work with. We asked them, how much infrastructure wiring did you save in your IP project? Well, at WOR, they saved about 2,000 feet of multi-pair. For audio in control, each of Tom's nine studios, two runs of Cat 6, and one is just a backup. So they're on one full-time Cat 6, and then the other's just there in case somebody comes through with a nice pair of sharp wire cutters and cuts something off. 300 pair of multi-feet saved the 1010 Winds, a little bit more condensed of a facility. 500 feet at QXR, same there, and even less so at the Metropolitan Opera House. But scrap copper is anywhere from about 230 to 450 a pound right now. So the price of copper has gone up exponentially, and the time to punch it down and all really kind of adds to your cost. So we're saving there. How much other wiring products such as punch blocks, D-ring hangers, cable ties did these guys save doing the install? About 60%, they say, over traditional methods. And with Axia, they didn't have to outsource the cabling. They saved about half the time over previous cabling methods. They saved about 50% of the time and labor over previous experience. And roughly half the time, actually, older methods would not have worked due to tight infrastructure in some of these facilities. Especially in these older facilities that have been around a long time in New York City, for example, space is at a premium. Real estate is jammed. You know, if you go into some of these places, the troughs are so full of cable, they don't know where it goes. The previous engineer came in, cut off an end here or there, and you've got cables that go to nowhere. So that's an issue. In this case, they saved over 60% in extra stuff at WOR, some of the other things that they've done. How much wiring did they save, if any, in the studios? Not just from the rack room, like we saw on that first slide, to the studios, but actually in the studio itself. About 1,000 feet at WOR. They cut it in about half of what they would normally do at 1010 Winds. And they did studio wiring themselves at QXR and at the Metropolitan Opera House. So there's a consistent and recurring theme here. They're saving time and money on the install. Now, how much labor did they save? Well, 2 days per studio, 18 days altogether for Tom. 50%. I've really seen this slide change in the last couple years. I've been now with Telos for 2 years, and I've seen this really go down quite a bit. We did an install. There was one project at Motor Racing Network where the first one went in, and it took the guy about 5 hours to install the first console before he had audio pumping through it. Second one was done in about two and a half hours, so he cut that time in half. Once he got used to the whole install and the application process. So it got much better and faster as time went on. Differences in making configuration changes with Axia versus our previous systems. And the differences we see are they're much simpler. It takes a fraction of the time because it's done in a GUI. We can actually go in, and once it's wired and connected and it's on our network, we have access to it wherever we want. And we can do basically whatever we need to do with a computer as opposed to going in and tracing down and getting the sniffer out and finding out where that signal is on that punch block because the documentation is unavailable at any moment. So what they've done now is it's made it much simpler for them to actually get in and do things to the system and make it suit your needs. You know, a great story here with his big butt. Well, let's go back to it. Rodney is a funny guy here at QXR. And as he was getting his install in and up and rolling, very tight quarters at WQXR. So he's in his rack room, and he actually, on his chair, put a node and put it right down on his seat and took a phone call, and he was busy doing a couple of other things and came back and took that phone call, pulled his chair out, and where did he sit? Not even looking down, but he sat on that node. And it wasn't working after that. He ended up crashing the node. It's not butt rated, okay? These things are great and they work well, but they're not rated for sitting on them. But the story here is what he did after it was broken, and he called me and said, "What do I do?" He unplugged it, basically grabbed another one he had, plugged it in, little reconfiguration. It was ready to go in 5 minutes. So that's really the benefit, is you're versatile in case of simple mistakes that happen. You know, just goofy little things that go on, you can actually make that adjustment on the fly. And this is radio. We got to be ready to think fast on our feet. So what are the implications for maintenance with IP audio? Are you saving labor, time, trouble? Any new installation comes with some infant mortality, as, you know, we've seen in the past. Plug it in, it gets tested at the factory, looks okay, they plug it in on site, and it blows up right then and there. You know, there's a component failure at some point. Now, this is the case with the three failures here. They were all out of the box or during installation testing phases. So, not much is needed as far as maintenance once it works. And if you can talk to some of the folks that have this IP-based system, they'll agree with you. Terry Kegley at the back of the room, we were just talking about that before I came up. They've got, once it's been on, it's just been fine and not a problem. Greg Dahl, for example, as well. He, the gentleman that introduced me, he put in a couple of IP nodes for an STL backup. And the thing's been cooking since they plugged it in for over a year now with no problems whatsoever. So the stuff gets in, it plugs in, and it just doesn't really require much beyond that until you want to make a change. So here's another good point for us to think about how much we're saving in the whole process. It's not just a cheaper box. What sort of problems go away with IP audio? Well, poor connections go away. Phase issues, open pairs, no mix-minus errors, no cross pairs. No punch block failures, no bad punches, troubleshooting's easier. And if you look here at what the gentlemen say, they confirm that. No separate engineer is generally needed for various submixes, like the Metropolitan Opera House. They have, instead of having a live sound console to do a submix or something really complicated like that, well, what they do is they create a virtual mix. And that virtual mix goes on in the background, and they've got all their microphones down on their stage connected to one fader in their master control, which is hundreds of feet away. So it just makes things easier when it comes to having to get up and make a change on the fly. Now, what troubleshooting problems do you have with an IP audio system? What does it create? You know, I mean, we all sit there, it really creates us a need for us to think a little differently when we're doing an install. At least some IP information or experience is helpful. We have to know what an IP address is. The more you get into the network aspect of it, the more helpful it becomes when we're talking IP. And you got to kind of think outside of the box instead of our little old way of doing things with that twisted pair and making sure that a source goes into a channel and that channel's a mic channel, so I got to make sure it's mic level or line level. We don't really think about that stuff anymore. I mean, we do to a point, but we think about more to it. Engineers now need, like Tom says, some more IP education or experience. Mr. Tobin says it's challenging for, you know, guys with no IP experience. And the young kid at the end of the block here, no problems whatsoever troubleshooting. So some of the younger guys are a little bit more in tune to that IP stuff than, you know, some of the more experienced RF engineers that are out there. But even those guys are starting to see more need for IP. Okay, during installation, did IP audio systems benefit you in some way that they didn't expect? And what do they say? They say yes. In master control and in the studios, they're much quicker to put together than Tom thought they'd be. And Tom goes back now. He was one of our first really big installs. So he was really cutting edge on some of this stuff. And not even cutting edge so much as bleeding edge. He was really pushing the limit. And Tom and Chris really worked together in a lot of great ways. They're while they're competitive stations, they're both news talk stations in New York City. Well, things go on in New York City that, like the Giants won the parade last year, won the NFL championship. And they had their parade on Broadway. So the ticker tape parade comes down. Well, Chris's studios were at the time up at 57th Street, really nowhere near where the parade was culminating. And Tom's studios looked down onto the parade route. So what he could do, he brought, Chris called Tom, said, hey, can I come over and, you know, work with you? Can you get me a view to the street below? Well, not only did Tom do that, he threw a node in this conference room. They strung it in to their switch and routed a feedback to an extreme, a Zephyr extreme, and Chris was broadcasting from the street right there looking down on it and fed up to 1010 Winds. They've also done some really great things as far as they've done that a couple of times with parades in New York City and had to make a source available and just kind of camaraderie and workmanship together. How does that IP audio make your work easier? Well, save time and money, again. If you need a difference in a console or mix minus config, it's really simple to do. Chris had a great story here about, let's go back, the Big Butt incident. Well, I guess my timing was off on that. Chris talked about being the ABC election story. They were getting ready. 1010 Winds was doing election coverage for the primaries, and they were at ABC headquarters gathering up all the news that they could and the latest poll results and whatever was going on that night. Anybody who ever worked to do election coverage here? You know, I've done it a million times. I'm sure we all have to a certain extent. What kind of night is that like? It's hectic and crazy. You know that the day before you always get the news director coming up to you saying, hey, can we get this guy from this site or do something crazy at the last minute? Well, in this IP world, it's easy to do. But Chris's story here was really great. They were having an issue back in their facility with using a macro to create a virtual event take place. Actually, it was a real event, but the button to do it was virtual. And Chris actually was able to go directly into it, look at his system and VPN in, and make a change and had it back on, and the mix minus was all fed back to where it needed to go in a matter of seconds. It really impressed his news director quite a bit as he was looking over his shoulder and they're just harping on him at every second. You know, that there's nothing like that anxiety of being an engineer or an air talent and having the GM or the news director, your boss, whoever it may be, sitting on your shoulder hammering you, you know, and it was kind of nice for him to go, well, wait a minute, a couple of strokes of his keyboard, and they're up and running and back to where they needed to be. So here we're going to talk a little bit. I want to get back to that big butt story, and you can read it here. Finally, when Rodney called me to do it, and it became a big butt story because when he called me to tell me what had happened and needed an RA for that node that he crushed, I immediately started with the song. I started singing to him, "Rodney's got a big old butt, oh yeah," and he started laughing. So it was just a funny story as he reprogrammed and got things rolling relatively quickly on a Friday afternoon that would have otherwise been a really bummer of a weekend. So what do we come up with that IP audio works as reliably as other technologies? Installation cost savings are realized both in infrastructure and studios. Wiring accessories, labor are reduced to 50-60%. And this is a common theme that we're seeing throughout all these installs. Many audio problems are eliminated due to short audio wire runs, simple connections, and Ethernet's groundbreaking topology. Convenience is increased. Oh, hold on. IP audio systems are flexible and configurable. Well, we've seen that. And convenience is increased even toward remote configuration and troubleshooting. So this is what we're really starting to see in the industry and what we're seeing with IP audio. While I don't have those hard numbers that, you know, everybody wants to see when we talk about how much we're saving, we just kind of went out and asked the guys in the field. You know, for folks that are here that have an IP-based system, you know, Terry, as far as saving, what did you see when you did your install? Yeah, it's really made it a much easier and simpler process when you're doing this. And that's why we're now starting to see more and more IP audio out there as far as, you know, how many years ago we all sat there and said, this IP audio thing is trendy. You know, it's technology that's not really ready for prime time or it's kind of black magic. And now we're seeing everybody that's in the industry starting to address it and make it a reality. Others that have done standard IP, any IP stuff? Are there any other guys here that have done any? Ken Caldwell here.
I said it's impossible to compare because I can have any audio source available anywhere.
Yeah.
In the facility, where to try and do that with over copper was impossible, and you know, plus you're adding all the DA costs and all the other things that. You know, you got the node, you put it on the network, and it's available. So
yeah, yeah.
I said, I can't give you a number because I said there's just, it's so many more times the things that I can do now with it that I said we never would even consider to have done before because of the costs or cabling and everything else.
Sure.
So it's awesome.
So now what else are you doing that's different than the old way? Well, as the microphone walked away. That's okay. No big deal. Anybody, questions from anybody? I've pretty much wraps up my part of the presentation, but I want to answer some questions that folks might have or concerns that, you know, you're seeing in installs that you're doing. I mean, hey, money's tight these days, tighter than ever. It'll change in a few months, right? So they tell us. Mr. Huntley.
What sort of a delay between nodes on a node-to-node circuit do you normally figure? And the reason that I'm asking that is that we just put in an automation system that's based on Axia nodes. And I had an extra node and moved it to transmitter site and was using it to feed an SCA for high school football remotes. And I had to rethink that on the fly and move it back to analog because it was a little too much for people in the field. So
yeah,
that's why I'm asking.
It's 2.75 milliseconds for that conversion, but when that's that's in your case where you were doing it and using it in that application, it's times two, so it's about 5 milliseconds.
But Jim, in notes, there's two different settings, or actually there's a couple more. You got the fast and the slow settings. So does that rate change with those?
No, that's basically a priority type of application. When you load a source into our system, we label it as there's a type of stream. And Greg was referring to a fast stream or a slower stream. And that's for things, the difference is priority. So we want to have fast streams go directly to air. And slower streams aren't meant for direct-to-air type of applications. So something that might be going on a virtual mix in the background, something that's not going to be on when I hit that microphone on, I want it to go directly to air. That's a fast stream. But if I'm recording a device that's feeding, you know, a satellite feed on, you know, Casey Kasem's coming in at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday in the afternoon and it's going to air, you know, Sunday night, then it's not really that critical. Anybody else? Any other questions? Sir.
Now, what about reliability of the system itself? What if your system goes down flat, flat in that particular case? Would the entire radio station go flat on its base, or do you have to actually buy two so you've got an active backup?
Well, I recommend fully that you, for redundancy purposes, you build an exact duplicate studio of what you've already done, because I've got two kids that are about ready to go into college. So the more you buy, the happier I am. But no, in all honesty, it just depends on how you design your system. It's no more unreliable than the old way of doing things. And that's because you put in a switch in a studio. You know, and if a studio goes down or a switch goes down somewhere, there's something else to take its place. So you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket. You're going to distribute your liability throughout your design. And one of those ways is a core edge type of topology for your switch fabric. Another way of doing it is not sharing all your, and putting all your sources on one of those. We kind of spread it out. Guys.
Also, with your core switch, there's, if you go with the higher end switches like Cisco and some of the others, there's redundancy. So you can set up two switches so that if one fails, the other continues.
Yeah. And with that switch, generally I set it up basically the same using two different network switches, but I use software-wise, I forgot the name.
Subnet.
No, not by Subnet. VLAN, I'm sorry, couldn't think of it. But separate by VLAN between the two switches, so you plug in half your nodes or your audio engine stuff into those, you split them between there, and also use the other side for, like, your automation. You want to keep that separate. And this way, if one goes out, you can then pick and choose if you don't have enough ports open, or you can move them all up into the second switch and then get the other one repaired. This way you get your redundancy, because that's really where the failure point is, because if a node goes down, you can switch out the node very quickly, and if you keep up the configuration, you know, in a backup file somewhere, reloading that very quickly, you can get back on the air very soon.
Yeah. So I want to thank all you folks for coming in today. As I usually don't have a room this large, and I feel like I should have a guitar and maybe a drum kit behind me or something. Maybe we can get Phil Owens to come up and do a little guitar work. And I'll just fake along. But thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.